You are listening to The New Man, Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier. He is joined in the studio by the show's producer, Casey Capshaw.
Did you know Barack Obama and John McCain both grew up with absent fathers? How does not having a father figure while growing up affect every aspect of your life? And if you're one of the millions of sons without a dad, what can you do to take responsibility and move forward? This week, author and speaker Byron Ricks is here to share his personal story, which led him to write the book Searching for Dad, The 9 Side Effects of Growing Up Fatherless and How to Overcome Them. Welcome to The New Man. Today, I've got professional speaker and corporate trainer, as well as the author of Searching for Dad, The 9 Side Effects of Growing Up Fatherless and How to Overcome Them. Byron Ricks, welcome to The New Man.
Thank you, Trip. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. I just recently read a little piece that you had written that profiled Barack Obama and John McCain. And despite their differences politically, they grew up with absent fathers. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, they grew up with the fathers not being in the home on a daily basis, though Barack Obama's father was not only not at home, he was not even in the picture, whereas McCain's father just was in the Navy, so he was not at home. And the reason I talk about the two is because as I interviewed men, I found those side effects were the same regardless of the father being there, and I'm sorry, if the father was not in the home, then boys tended to suffer the same, some of the same side effects, not all of them, but some of the same feelings of void and some of the same feelings of belonging and not having that bond that boys tend to need. So that was the correlation.
And so it doesn't, if I hear you correctly, it doesn't matter if the guy, if the father just up and left and was completely out of the picture, or if he was, I'm imagining just at a much a higher level orbit that he just kind of popped in and out, but day to day, not being in the home had this, had the very same impact on the boy.
Yes. In many of the side effects, not all of them, but as it relates to the bonding experience, it was the same. The void that the boys felt, it was the same. The lack of value the boys felt, it was the same.
Okay. And so how does that impact our view of these two candidates, which have a potential to greatly impact our future, not only as Americans, but as citizens of the world? What do you see?
Well, I think both candidates, well, let's back up a moment, if I may.
Sure.
When we experience a traumatic situation, and not having your father in my mind is traumatic, people experience traumas all the time with the floods and things that are going on today. But how you respond to those is what's important. And I think the thing that's significant for both McCain and Obama is that though their fathers weren't there, they still aspired to achieve and do well with their lives, and regardless of their fathers being there, or in spite of, should I say, their fathers being there. When a lot of guys don't respond the same way, if their father's not there, that guidance is not there, that bonding is not there, they sort of go listless through life as a ship without a sail.
Let's dive into your book here, The 9 Side Effects of Growing Up Fatherless. What are those 9 side effects, or can you kind of paraphrase them?
The 9 is, one, we talk about the identity crisis. When a boy looks in the mirror, especially a little boy, young boy, 4 or 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old, he looks in the mirror as he grows and begins to mature. He is looking for characteristics of his father. And if his father's not there, then that leaves this void in him, this unknown. I'm looking for my nose. Is my nose developing like my father's, my cheekbones? You know, and if my father is there with me, I look at my father constantly, not necessarily my mother at that age. Hmm. Also, we have this silent anger, we call, because we are angry because we are left. We're angry because our father's not there. We're angry because other fathers are there. We're angry with God. We're angry with my parents. We're angry with our siblings. We're angry with the people around us because this father is not there to play catch and to interact with us. And we tend to have a need to belong. Studies have shown that boys without fathers are more likely to join gangs and more likely to be involved with some group that makes them feel like they belong to something. Then we talk about their value. They underestimate their own values. For boys without fathers, they tend to equate value with monetary things and not self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because there's no one there to validate them, I just completed a seminar yesterday, men's group seminar that I'm doing, Searching for Dad. And guy said, I'm 63 years old. And you're right, I never feel validated by my father. My father died when I was 8 years old, and I've never felt validated. And that's a part of it. You just never feel valued. And he's been a successful businessman who's raised several children. He's 63 years of age. And then there's this question of character, number five. Without fathers, who models character for us and for the boys? That's typically where we get it from. We get it from our fathers. At least that's where we should get it from if our father is of good character.
Uh-huh.
And then respect. A father doesn't show boys respect. In fact, when they leave, it's disrespectful. They don't respect them. They don't learn respect from the mom. Well, I won't say they don't learn it from the mom. I get myself in trouble. But it's not the same process as what boys go through.
Right.
I play catch with my dad, as Guy said. They interact, they're rough, they tumble. I mean, those are the kinds of things that boys like. And then there's that infamous void where you feel incomplete.
Mm.
You know, we try to fill that void with sex or violence or drugs or alcohol or all kinds of activities, but that needing to belong to that void that's there inside of us doesn't allow us to be whole. And so we search for it and we try to fill it with all different things. But yet when we lay in bed at night and look at the ceiling after having done all that we've done, the void is still there. And number eight, we talk about the sex or the lopsided view in that if my dad wasn't there for me, he has taken no responsibility for my upbringing, then what that tends to perpetuate itself. These boys now are out in the world, they're old enough, they're making babies, and they don't understand the role they have. And I did a TV show in Atlanta, and the host asked me, well, how soon should you start teaching your son about sex? When do they begin to learn? And I said, well, you have to understand that they begin to learn at the point they're cognizant of the relationship their parents have.
Mm.
As they note their father interactions with their mom, they're learning does how he kisses her or on the cheek or hugs her goodbye or hello, the greetings, the flowers, the gifts, the interaction teaches him subconsciously how you interact with your mom and with the female, and that gives them the respect for the female and also help them understand the responsibilities they have to the woman and to the kid. And then the last final side effect we talk about is not enough love. Boys without fathers often view love as a vulnerability, and they have a difficult time trusting. You know, you listen to a lot of the young boys today in the rap songs, and you hear this lyric over and over, but we don't love them, though. We're involved with these girls, but we don't love them, though.
Right.
We can't give them that part of us. We can't be vulnerable like that, only to our moms,
mm-hmm.
not to any other female, mom's grandmom or aunt or someone like that, but not to a female outside.
And so all of these areas, it sounds like this is what a father trains his son to do, whether it's directly or indirectly. It's not the father's responsibility to take on these things for his son, but this is where the son learns how to take this responsibility on for himself.
But the father plays an active role, I believe, in many of these.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in character. You know, I have a son, and my son got into some trouble, not big trouble, little thing, broke a window and things like that. And he wanted to tell me, well, Dad, it was this happened and that happened and this happened. And after he went through all of that, I said, did you break the window? Well, yeah. Well, if you broke the window, then regardless of the other circumstances, you have the responsibility of having broken that window. And we must go to these people, and we must apologize. But Dad, you paid them for the window. I understand I paid them for the window, but that doesn't take the place of a sincere apology from you for having broken the window.
Mm.
You see, that was a lesson on hand.
Uh-huh. I can understand at his age that, why, it's just the window, I need to move on, but there's this other interior part of respecting the other person, respecting their property, and and actually communicating that and sharing that.
Exactly.
You tell of these nine side effects or these attributes, you know, there's not really too many manuals on there about how to be a dad, or this is the impact of what's going to be on your son if you leave. So I'm curious how you came up with this. How did you come to recognize this?
Well, you know, in the book, I grew up, I talk about growing up, Trip, without my father. And I have always had these on my mind as I've interacted with other people. I travel for a living. I've been to 48 or 50 states. And, you know, pick an airport, pick a hotel, pick a restaurant. I've had a conversation with guys and even women who are raising boys. And we all seem to vacillate toward one or two or four, three of these different effects. And I thought, wow, this is not just me. You know, there are other men and other women who have experienced this. Women, of course, indirectly, in that raising kids or not having that guy there. And guys, the same thing, filling that void. We talk about it, yet we can't describe what it is. And so that's why we don't know what to fill it with, and that's why we try so many other things. So I just talked to so many people, and it came to fruition. Initially, I can't write a book just based on me.
Yeah.
I have to get out here and find out if indeed these things are valid, or is this just what I experienced myself.
Did you always feel a kinship to other boys and other young men that didn't have fathers? Or was this something that, as you shared it, like you were talking about just a second ago, like, oh my God, I'm not alone in this?
I went to Catholic schools. And in Catholic schools that I went to, there weren't many fatherless boys. In fact, I can't even remember another classmate who didn't have a father. And in the Catholic schools, it was multicultural. So all of my Hispanic friends, all of my Italian friends, my Polish friends, you know, all of them had dads. Mm. Even my black friends, or African-American friends, as they say today, had dads. But in the neighborhood that I lived in, it was common. I wouldn't say common in those days. I'm a little older, but it's more common now. But it was unusual. It wasn't unusual,
right,
for every one out of three kids or so not to have a father. But that wasn't the case. So I lived between these two worlds. In one world, I felt totally comfortable, in a sense, not having a dad. Though I missed him, it wasn't something that I felt badly about. But in the other world, I felt really badly about it because it was a family-oriented, you know, school, institution, and everything they did was around family, and I didn't have that other piece of my family there, and so that's when I really felt it.
Yeah, I saw one of the titles of the chapters in your book is Take Your Father to School Night or something like that, Without a Father.
Take Your Son, Father-Son Night.
Father-Son Night Without a Father. Yeah,
right.
I can imagine that would be very hard.
That was, you know, I believe, is really where the book began. sitting in my friend's car, his dad took me, my twins, Daryl and Darwin, I'll never forget them, and their dad took me. Mm. And I had a great time, but I can remember sitting there watching them interact with their dad, and what they had is what I wanted. And I got jealous,
mm-hmm.
And I got angry, and I got quiet. And I didn't say anything on the way home. And I remember that dad kept asking me, "Are you okay, Byron? What's wrong?" And I would say, "No, sir, I'm fine. Thank you, sir." You know, did you eat too much cotton candy? Did you eat too much popcorn? "No, sir, I'm fine." It's just that I was perturbed.
And was that a moment for you where you realized, "Hey, this is not okay with me"? It seemed like you got it at the school that you were an outsider of sorts, but in your neighborhood it was another thing. Is this where you started to really connect it? I imagine, like, this is deeper. This is really not okay with me.
Right, right. That's when I really began to connect it. It's not okay with me, and that was in that same time frame. I began to asked my mother that I want to make contact with him. I want to talk to him. I want to interact with him. I want to connect with him.
How old were you at this point?
I think I was around 11.
Okay.
Okay. I want to say, because that was sixth grade, so somewhere around 11.
Yeah.
When I was 13, I talked about it. My aunt passed away, and my mom arranged for my dad, who was a mortician, to actually take the body, and he came to a friend's house to see me and spent about an hour with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the greatest moment I ever felt in my life to that point.
How so?
Well, it was just, I was lit up like a Christmas tree.
Mm.
I felt whole again. It's kind of strange. As I talk about in the book, when my father picked me up and he held me and he hugged me, I felt a sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike my mother's bosom, where I felt some security but some comfort. But with my father, I felt a sense of security and strength and protective kind of security.
Yeah.
And each time I was around him, I felt this protective kind of security that I didn't feel with my mom. And I don't know, I guess it's hard to really explain that, to put that into words.
Yeah, I imagine there's an assumption here that it should just be okay to have one, but it's not. It really does require two parents to raise the kid, at least.
It does. And one of the challenges that I get from single moms, and I all the time, was, I can raise my kid by myself. I don't need a man to raise him. And that might be true. And I'm talking about women who will say this, six-figure women. Have said this to me, and I'll say to them, it is true that you can raise this son by yourself monetarily. However, this boy will want his father. But and the same is true for girls. I mean, I have a lot of women say, you can even raise some for girls. I want my father too. I love my father. I wish I had my father in my life.
Yeah.
You know, but their kids, and I tell them, will want the father. They will want to interact with the father regardless of what you can buy them, regardless of the social economic ladder that you're on. You can be at the top rung or the bottom rung. Without a father, the kid feels the same way.
Take me back to the moment where you got to spend that moment with him when you were 13. Yeah. He came back and met you at the party or wherever you were.
It was early evening, and I was really anticipating him coming. And then it began to get dark, and it was drizzy and rainy, and not heavy rain, just a light drizzle kind of rain. And the door was open, because those are small homes in the South, so we sat there in the living room area, and I was just stared out that door. And it was amazing. He was just there in no time, it seemed.
Mm.
And when he walked through the door, he had on his coat and hat, and he seemed like a large man. And he smiled, and at that point, goosebumps just went up and down my arms. It was like, this is my dad. And I immediately began to look at his face and his nose and his cheekbones and his lips and his ears, his hair. You know? And I ran and I hugged him before he could get the coat off.
Uh-huh.
And I just grabbed him, I hugged him, and it's a funny thing. The odor, it was an odor that was familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered that odor. I'd smelled him before. That was an odor that I missed.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt just wonderful, you know, just to be there with him and talk to him. And I remember the conversations I asked him. I said, aren't you afraid of dead people?
Because he was a mortician, right?
Yeah, he's a mortician. And he said, no, it's not the dead ones that you have to be afraid of, son. He said, it's the live ones you have to be afraid of. And, you know, it was just, he had wit, he had charm. And a thing I noted is my mother was as bright as me.
Hmm.
You know, through all these years, she had shown no real emotion as related to my father. But when he was there in that room, she was lit up, she was smiling, she was engaged him in conversation. I mean, it was just a beautiful thing. In my mind, this is the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
You know,
why can't it be like this?
Yeah, why can't it be like this?
Yeah,
and it wasn't, and it didn't ever happen that way. So
you had that one that one meeting with him, and was he out of your life for good after that, or?
When I was, I want to say 17 or 18, we had a family reunion in Georgia, and I went. Off on my own, I asked people. Everyone knew him, so it was easy to find him.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the funeral home, and he was there. And when I walked in, he looked at me, and he hadn't seen me again since I was 13. So this was at least, 5 years later, so I'm about 18. And we talked. He was real apprehensive, but he was apprehensive because I was in his on his territory now, because his house was adjacent to the funeral home. And his wife was back there. He has two daughters, and he was a little nervous that I was there.
Yeah,
you know. But I remember he had his degree on the wall on the back of his office. He had his degree on the wall, huge, and it was framed. And I remember looking at that, thinking, "Wow, I'm gonna, you know, that's neat. That would have influence." And then he turned behind him and he grabbed a book from his bookshelf, and he opened it to a page, and he pushed it to me and asked me to read it. I guess, I don't know, maybe I looked ignorant.
He was testing you to see if you could read, right?
Yeah, he was testing me and see if I could read, you know. And so I read, you know, a paragraph or two, and I kept reading. And then he just said, "Oh, okay, that's good." And he grabbed it back from me, and we talked, you know, about his business. And he was paranoid that I wanted money from him.
That was the one reason why you would come back, but it's really a much deeper reason that you wanted to feel a nurture that connection that was there.
Exactly. Well, now, if we have a relationship at this point in my life, I'm okay if we don't. I mean, I'm really okay.
Right.
I won't be on my deathbed saying, "Boy, I wish I could see my dad."
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm through that. I'm over it. That's why I said 9 side effects and how to overcome them. I've overcome many of them, and I live with others.
It seems like that a guy could be in this place where he feels very victimized, or that, you know, screw that. You know, I didn't have a father, so therefore I'm lost and whatever. He can kind of collapse into that place for himself. But what I'm getting is that recognizing these side effects, There's a part in there where you take responsibility for yourself and quit waiting for that your father to actually do this stuff for you. Did that occur for you, and how did you do that?
For me, and I don't know about others, but for me, again, I went to Catholic schools, so I had a faith-based education, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and for me, that is what helped me understand and identify these things, and understand that I had a greater life and there was a larger world, and there were a lot of things for me to do and accomplish, and I couldn't dwell in the past. I had to, you know, leap forward toward the future and reach toward the future. And so that's what did it for me. My faith said this is larger and life's bigger than this, because you can't undo it. So, you know, you have to take responsibility for who you are today. You're grown now.
Right.
You're a man. And what happened from birth to 21, you might not be able to control so much or have a lot to do with. But from 21 to death, it's all about you.
And that's what you were relating to earlier on in our conversation, that what we can learn from, say, Barack Obama and John McCain is how they chose to move forward in a conscious way. Like, okay, that my dad was gone, or my dad wasn't around growing up, but here's what I'm going to do now.
Right. When I think about Barack Obama, I was listening to him talk about his dad, and he did go to Africa, and he did go search for his dad. You know, and he found his dad, and he went to his dad's grave, and he, you know, sat there, and he talked about talking to his dad, and he understood the character of his father. He wanted to learn who his father was, but also his father was an educated man, you know, and that inspired Barack Obama to get a higher education as well. He wanted to do better than his father. That, you know, in his mind, I'm going to go one step above and better than my father. And I can remember looking at that degree when I was listening to Barack saying, "Yeah, I want to do one better than my father." And I was listening to John McCain. He talked about being shot down. He said, "But I was really cocky because my father and grandfather were admirals, and they had accomplished a lot. And so I didn't feel like I could ever be shot down. I could, you know, in the Navy, accomplish more than them." And that's one of the things that happens with us boys who grow with our fathers, even those with fathers. We have this innate desire to show them,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get even in a sense.
Right.
To be better than them, you know. I remember I was listening to D.L. Hughley, who grew up with a comedian who grew up with a stepdad, and he says that his father finally came into his life, and he said, "You're not my father. You're just the man that helped me get here. I had to clean that up." I forgot it was D.L. Hughley. And so even when we talk about Shaq, when he talks about, you know, his father telling him, "I'm your dad," he said, "No, you're not my dad. You know, you might be my biological father, but you're not my dad. You're not the man that raised me. Mm. And so another point to that is we don't necessarily have to have our biological fathers in our lives if we have a surrogate there, a male role model, somebody there that takes some interest in us. It could be a grandfather. It could be an uncle. It could be someone in, some counselor, some male that takes a genuine interest in the well-being of that boy can suffice to mm-hmm. help that boy get through these these side effects and even not develop some of them.
Yeah. I can totally, totally see that. Back to the thing about kind of doing something in spite of the father, whether he was present or not, is mm-hmm. that along the same lines, like maybe the flip side of the coin to the kind of the collapsing into the victim thing? Or is yeah. there a middle road? Can you speak about that? Where you're like, regardless of my father and where he was, I'm going to do my thing. And I'm not doing it just to show him. Can you speak about that?
Most of my research, you had people that either were hot or cold, in a sense. I didn't meet too many people in the gray area as it related to being successful economically. You had guys who just really, when I say that, and having said that, there are some guys I met that they put their fathers out of their lives and they were going to live their lives. They were going to be successful in spite of. Then there were those who wanted to be successful to show this father that, hey, I'm better than you, or I didn't need you.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the guys that I ran into and interviewed and we had the conversation with. And then that other one who just, for whatever reason, self-esteem was so low that they weren't able to pull themselves up.
Yeah. How important is it for you, I'm imagining, if someone's listening right now and they're like getting a hit, like an intuitive hit, like, oh, this makes so much sense. And they're alone though. Maybe they didn't have a faith-based education growing up or a surrogate. Is this something, this kind of healing that needs to take place here, is this something that they can do alone, or is it best to do with the group? Like, I remember you talking about other guys and I imagine that was very healing. What would you tell that guy that's by himself?
Well, I think that this guy, first, I think the book would help him get on the right track. But I do think that he would need someone, whether it be a professional person, a psychologist type person, or, just any type of mentor, an older person that can relate, someone that he trusts, because he has to open up, about what he's feeling, and he has to disclose, and he has to have someone that he trusts so that he can disclose and open up about what he feels. And I guess you might ask, well, why do you have to do that? Well, that's what begins the healing process. If you ever go, not that you would, but if you ever heard about AA meetings,
uh-huh.
my graduate studies is in human behavior, and in a practicum, I had to go to an AA meeting, and they say that, when they stand up, they say that, my name is Byron Rich, and I'm an alcoholic, or my name is John Doe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Right.
And at the end of this hour, when I met with the counselor, and I said, why each time a person stands up, they have to say that? If they stand up five times, they have to say that. They've already said that. And he said, Byron, not until they come to grips with whom they are, what they have done, will they be able to then move forward and heal themselves? So they must talk through it. They must be able to understand the feelings, talk through the feelings, and no longer hold those feelings in and allow those feelings to hijack them.
Mm.
So when they let them out like that, they're releasing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are finding that others can relate because they have gone through the same things they have. And then that builds that camaraderie and that builds that trust. And you're able to open up. And then once you have opened up and stripped down, we can begin to rebuild.
Yeah, I'm imagining it's like before I can get to where I want to go, I've got to acknowledge where I am now.
Yes,
and here,
absolutely.
Right now I'm spurned or hurt or devastated that I didn't grow up with my father, whatever that may be true for that person.
Exactly. I've had men, in the men's group when we go through the anger model. And one guy 2 weeks ago, he said, I didn't realize it till right now, but I'm still angry with him.
Uh-huh.
you know, and these guys, you know, 40s and 50s, he said, I thought I had forgiven him, because as we go through the forgiveness process, he said, I thought I had forgiven him, but I realize now that I haven't, and I'm still arguing with him.
Mm.
You know, and sometimes these guys' fathers are dead.
Yeah.
You know, and they can't go back and say anything to them. So if you don't want to figure out how to work this out and find someone to work this out with you, then you harbor that anger. And we know that anger contributes to all types of health issues.
Oh, yeah.
And so we don't want that.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me your experience in these men's groups, because I facilitate men's groups, and we haven't had one basically that centered around fatherless men. But tell me about your experience with them. How do they work with you in regards to the work that you do?
Well, the men's groups have spun off from the book because there are people who want more. One of the biggest things I get in my men's group experience is that men whose father never said, I love you, never voiced those words. Those words never came through their lips.
Mm-hmm.
I love you. Their mothers have, but not their fathers. And so we work through the pain of not having heard that and wanting to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And we work through that pain, and we work through the pain of the anger, you know. And for those who don't know their father at all, then the identity crisis become one, because they can only identify with their mother's side of the family.
Right.
They don't know where that bloodline goes on the father's side. So then that becomes an issue with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, we work through filling value. And then there are exercises that we do that are assessments that I give to help them understand how angry they really are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how that anger impacts those around them.
Right.
You know. And some of them are shocked.
It's like a poison that permeates our lives until we choose to directly yes. deal with it.
Yes, I had a man break down and cry, and he said, you know, I have become my father to my children, and that's not good. And so for him, the workshop was to help him release that and become the father that he is and not the father that his father was or was not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so different men come for different healings.
I'm struck by what you said earlier, is that some of these guys, their fathers are dead. They're passed away. And so we can't count on the part of this recovery process to be that you're going to be able to sit down with your father and have a heart-to-heart and get a shared reality. But the healing can still happen if you work with others that get what you're going through and can help facilitate that. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Things feel a lot better if you know you're not in it by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if someone can relate, that just helps you heal. I get other fathers, too, who understand that because of divorce, they're not with their children. They're not with their sons. And, you know, I have a chapter called Angry Mama Drama. Because this mother is now angry and think that they're hurting the father. I'm talking about good fathers now, men who are really trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Yet the mother won't let them. And these fathers come and they're hurt, and they're saying, well, I need to, you know, interact with my kids. A gentleman yesterday, Richard, said, no, I'm married now. I have a one-year-old, but I have three kids that I still don't feel like I'm a part of their lives, and I can't connect with them because two of them are angry with me because of something, you know, their mother said, I'll be divorced, whatever, and I just don't know how to do and what to do. And I was working with him on saying, look, ask them to forgive you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what you think you did or didn't do, in their mind, you've done something.
Yeah.
So you ask them to forgive you, you apologize, and then every correspondence you have with them, let it be sincere and open. Open the door. And if it takes 3 months, 3 years, eventually they will sense the genuineness of who you are and what you're trying to do. And they will connect back with you.
Mm-hmm.
And now he just said, you know, I never thought about it that way.
Mm.
Continue on. Don't give it up. Exactly.
So what's the thing, the guy that's out there listening right now, definitely go pick up the book. And where can he get the book, Searching for Dad?
Amazon.com is probably the best place.
Okay,
to get
so
it.
Amazon.com. But what else can he do besides get this in his head, so to speak?
I think once you get it in your head, if you do our faith-based, I think that's the place to start with a faith-based organization. If you're not faith-based, then I think that you have to find a professional, counselor that could, you can bounce things off of, because you got to begin some dialogue with someone. And even if it's someone in the family, you know, you say, well, I don't have any money. Is there anyone in your family or friends that you really trust, that you can disclose to, that you can open up to? And if they are, then that's the place to go. Because you've got to begin to talk about it.
How do I find more about you? Where do I go? Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Byron Ricks, BYRONRICKS, one word, ByronRicks.com.
Okay, and that's where we'll learn more about your speaking and corporate training, as well as the books and stuff that you've got.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Okay, excellent. Byron, thank you for being on the show. I'm aware how important my father has been in my life, and always could feel the difference in the men in my life that didn't have the father. So it just feels good to have someone say, hey, there is something here, and here's something you can do about it. So I just appreciate the work you're doing here.
Well, thank you.
All right, Byron, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. Visit triplinear.com and let us know what you think of the New Man podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.